Welcome to In The Frame, an exciting new podcast series where we're delighted to be touring the UK, meeting business leaders, and taking a look at the big picture of what makes businesses tick. I'm Paul Kempster.
And I'm Andrea DeLay. And together we co-head the mid-corporate business for Barclays, as well as being co-hosts for this podcast series.
I'm here today in beautiful Edinburgh, and I'm joined by William Weems, who is the Chief Executive of the Weems Development Company, and also by my colleague Jamie Grant, who is the head of corporate banking in Scotland. I'm delighted that you've taken the time to join us today, William. I know from speaking to you previously that you have a really quite remarkable business, multi-generational, highly diversified in terms of product and geography. So tell us a bit about the big picture of your business.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here with Barclays. Yeah, so we're a family business based across the road in Edinburgh. We were coal miners originally in Fife, where we both owned the minerals and operated the mines themselves. And when they were nationalized just after the Second World War, my grandfather and my father started investing some of the proceeds abroad, mainly in sort of Kenya, Australia, more latterly in France. And then our generation have been focused, I suppose, more on building up the businesses here in the UK and particularly in Scotland to provide some balance to the portfolio. So as you say, it's diversified across both geography and sector.
So that's fantastically interesting, and particularly the coal mining aspect, which I think you said was harking back to the 1700s.
Yes, quote me on that. My sister's better on the detail of the history than I am. So I'm just, yeah, that's my understanding, yeah.
So tell us a little bit more then. So from coal mining in the 1700s, post-war, and then geographically expanding into Kenya, Australia, and then France. So maybe just tell us a little bit about each of those geographic businesses.
Well, as somebody described my father the other day, said he enjoyed adventure capital rather than venture capital. So I suppose that sort of encapsulated what he did in terms of sort of going out to Kenya and planting up farms with tea and similar types of ventures in Australia and in France. So they're all the overseas businesses, all have a basis in land and agriculture primarily, but doing different things on the land, you know, that we think will work from a commercial, from an economic standpoint.
Well, that's really interesting actually to hear about that use of the infrastructure, almost the land, which I guess will have changed from generation to generation in line with changes in trends, opportunities, wherever that geography may be. So maybe give us an example about how you've seen that change. I think you were talking to me about the tea moving into some other products.
Yes. So in Kenya, our core business is as a tea producer, but more latterly, we've been experimenting and diversifying into superfoods. So we had, or we do continue to have, in fact, an avocado business in Australia. So we wanted to apply some of that expertise to growing and marketing avocados in Kenya. So we've been trying to use the land somewhat differently to plant avocados and then pack and market avocados. And a similar story with other superfoods such as blueberries and blackberries as well, which are obviously high in antioxidants. And we believe we'll have sort of long-term, there'll be bumps, you know, supply and demand imbalances, but we believe we'll have long-term growth prospects in terms of growing consumer awareness of the health benefits of these superfoods.
Thanks, William. That's absolutely fascinating to hear about the move, I guess, from tea plantations into superfoods. And a key theme really today of our discussion that we know that listeners will be really interested to hear about is those decision points. How do they come about? And why are those decisions made at that particular point in time? So using your example there of tea plantations to superfoods, could you tell us a bit more about that decision, how that came about?
Yes, I suppose part of it's risk management. You know, you're exposed to one global commodity. And if you're exposed to more than one global commodity, you're managing some of the risk associated with the tea market. So I suppose that was really the starting point to diversify the business in Kenya and use the land and water to diversify its revenue and hopefully profit base.
And, you know, from an environmental perspective, I could imagine there'd be some big considerations there as well, wouldn't there? Use of water and to make that decision to pivot towards superfoods.
Yeah, I mean, all the water that we use in Kenya is not coming from boreholes or anything like that. It's coming from the sky. And I know places in Europe now, particularly in Southern Europe, are having greater and greater water problems. So whilst we do have the challenges around getting that fresh produce to market. From a sustainability point of view, we believe that our approach to rainwater harvesting makes it, in terms of sustainability, it's a strong story.
Thank you. And I think particularly that sustainability angle, for me, it's another consideration for a management team who are considering diversification to achieve growth. And I guess just wanted to bring Jamie in actually at this point. And Jamie, you have the benefit of speaking to so many businesses in so many sectors across Scotland. And I know you have growth always on your agenda when you're speaking to management teams. What are you seeing thematically as the conditions for management teams to decide whether to do something or not? Do you think management teams are bold enough to take those growth decisions?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, obviously the geopolitical world we've been through and other things have made investment decisions more challenging at times. But I do think there's a lot of great businesses here in Scotland that are looking at opportunities to grow. And in those decision makings, as you said, ESG is a key topic that, as well as doing the right thing for the environment, there's cost-saving benefits of doing it as well. So I think people are balancing up those investment decisions. But what's really interesting about Bill's business is also not just the international aspect of it, but the fact as well is that we're doing a lot of work with the FT at the moment, the FT partnership, around businesses really harnessing the local and the national opportunities. And I know Bill's business has been through a lot of transition recently around really trying to grow that core business back in Scotland. And William, you can give us a little bit of an insight into how that strategy has changed from generation to generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we came into the business sort of 20 to 25 years ago, a lot of the revenue and certainly most of the profit, if not all the profit, came from overseas. And whilst our overseas businesses have a lot of attribute, managing businesses overseas from an arm's length is obviously more challenging than something in your own backyard that you can sort of see and touch every day. So we wanted to provide some greater balance to the portfolio. So we set out really to grow three sectors here in the UK and more specifically here in Scotland. One was spirits with a strong focus on Scotch whisky. Second was using our property base to grow our property business around investments and also residential and commercial development. And then finally, we built a number of hydro schemes in the renewable space using some of Scotland's great water assets.
And one of the decisions, William, you've always had is around longevity and investing for the long term. Is that right? Is that the common theme across a lot of the asset classes that you work
with? Yeah. I mean, certainly we believe that we invest for the long term. We're not short-termists. And I don't think we're dissimilar to a lot of other family businesses in that respect. And so any investment, material investment decisions we make are for the long term, and there's no more long-term business than Scotch whisky.
Absolutely. Yeah. The older it gets, the nicer it is and the more valuable it is, I think, isn't it? It's fair to say. So just zoning in on the whisky business, clearly, as you've said, you've got a very broad portfolio of businesses geographically and by type. But in terms of the whisky business in Scotland, which in the history of the overall family business is much more recent. That's clearly brought with it growth decisions. How do you invest in that? How do you market that at the right time? So could you tell us a little bit more about those key inflection points that you've had to take as a management team on the whisky business?
Yes. I mean, we started out as what they call an independent bottler. So taking casks of whisky from third-party distillers and blending and bottling it under our own brand Weems Malts. And then from there, there's a sort of seminal moment, whether you go on and either own or build a distillery, or whether you continue as an independent bottler. So in 2013, we got involved with a distillery project out near St. Andrews, near the home of golf, at a place called King's Barns, which was close to our ancestral home at Weems Castle, just literally down the Fife Coast. And we took that step because I think, well, for two reasons. A, sort of security of supply, so that, you know, we were distilling and maturing our own casks. And secondly, if you look around the Scotch whisky industry, there's a history of independent bottlers moving into owning their own distillers, whether it's great local family businesses like Ian McLeod here in Scotland, who've, in the years gone by, followed a similar path. Stuart Lang and his family, you know, there are multiple examples of that. So I don't think we were breaking new ground. We'd followed a reasonably well-trodden path. But it was, you know, it was either you've got to invest more capital in this business to get to the next stage, or you're just going to trundle along doing what you're doing and selecting mature barrels of whiskey. So we decided to build our own single malt distillery, which so far, touch wood, has been a good success.
And it's really interesting to hear you describe that as the seminal moment. And many businesses and clients out there will be facing their own seminal moments in their own industries. In reality, how long was that process? It's clearly more than a moment, but how long was it building up to that decision point?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I suppose it wasn't one light bulb moment. You had a number of moments where you could get off the train, whether it's around planning permission, ability to fund it, timescales for maturation. So it wasn't like you had a moment in time where you had to bet the house. You had the opportunity to exit if you wanted to exit. And the further down the track you went, obviously, the more you knew about it and the more comfortable you were going to have to be to go on with it. So, yeah, it wasn't just sort of one moment in time where you had to make a reasonably substantial bet. You had moments where you could exit stage left without having to continue.
That's a great analogy about moments you could get off the train. And what I'm hearing almost is there are challenges that can be thrown at you, whether they're planning or funding or whatever the case may be. To what extent, when you're making those growth decisions, investment decisions, they require resilience, they require a bit of patience, but also what sort of advice do you, if any, draw in to help you and the management team finally commit to those decisions?
I think that's a great question. We have active boards, whether it be at the parent or subsidiary level, and hopefully they have the right people in general on them who are more experienced than us in those respective industries. And we're able to lean on them for advice in terms of what they've been through, whether it be in the property industry, whether it be renewables, whether it be whiskey. People have been very generous with their advice based on their experience. And as you're going through the business and you're gaining more experience yourself, being able to lean on other people with more experience than you in that industry is very important, I think.
One of the things that always strikes me with the whiskey industry is how collaborative it is across. And William, you mentioned that, you know, other people have done that well-trodden path of diversifying from bottling and distributing to actually building and owning and running distilleries. Is that a true reflection of the whiskey industry? Is that what it feels like as an operator? Is it quite collaborative? Certainly outward looking in, it feels that way.
Yeah, particularly on the golf course. Yeah, it's very collaborative. We swap casks with each other. By and large, we don't have contracts. We all, certainly from production end, work together to try and grow the category. And it is very collaborative. When you explain how the Scotch whisky industry works to people in other industries, you see them slightly amazed because of how collaborative it is. But that's because it is a long-term industry and you're helping each other. And it's a small world here in Scotland. So your word is your bond in terms of if you commit to do something, you've got to do it. Yeah, it's a great industry.
William, you mentioned there's others that have trodden this path in terms of transitioning from bottling, distributing into actually manufacturing and owning. There are some role models out there. Did you tap into some people in the industry with that experience, have gone on that journey?
Yeah, people were very generous with their time and advice in terms of what they've been through. And I suppose it's just a reflection of an industry that is extremely collaborative and people who are prepared to give their time, which at that stage for them really had no sort of commercial benefit. They were just being generous, really.
From new competitive socialising activities to upgrading their premises, UK hospitality and leisure operators are finding creative ways to attract and retain customers. Our report explores how UK hospitality and leisure businesses are differentiating themselves by adding the cherry on the top for their customers and exceeding expectations. Go to barclayscorporate.com and search Evolving the Experience to read the full report and find out more.
It's uplifting, actually, to hear industries pull together in that way to promote collective growth. Undoubtedly, the business has been a success since that decision was taken. But I think you said earlier when we were talking, no journey is without bumps. And what would be really interesting to hear is if you reflect back on the last 10 years, and maybe we'll come to how you coped with the pandemic impact in a moment, but pre-pandemic, in that sort of early phase of growth, Looking back, would you have done anything differently? Any big learns from those decision making?
Yeah, I mean, there are, of course, I mean, it'd be very arrogant to say you wouldn't, if you haven't learned anything from your experiences, then you haven't really developed either as a person or as a sort of businessman. So of course there are things you would do differently. Yeah, I'm just trying to think. I don't think there's anything material we would have done differently. We probably could have done some things quicker than we have done and made bolder decisions. But I guess as a family business, we wanted to preserve the strength of our balance sheet for rainy days and unexpected downturns like COVID, for example, and not bet everything, you know, on one cycle. So I guess we could have been quicker to do things, but when you're doing it for the long term, it's better to be slow and steady rather than fast and unsteady, I suppose.
That's great advice. And I think it'd be remiss not to just discuss briefly the reaction to the pandemic in your own business. Yeah. Clearly, when you set out on a growth strategy, none of us have a crystal ball, but there would be an expectation of some degree of linear growth, and then events can occur, of course. So when you look back at the pandemic years, how, if at all, did that impact the growth of the business and any decision-making you had to then pivot towards as a management team?
We faced different challenges in different businesses across different geographies. I remember 6-9 months into the pandemic when we were in an Australian board meeting and they had no idea how to use Zoom or Teams. And it's like, well, you're obviously not that badly affected by the pandemic if you don't really know how to log on to Zoom or Teams. And that was quite a surprise, given we'd been spending the best part of our working day on Zoom every day for the last 6 to 9 months when we'd all been through the various lockdowns. Our businesses here, the hydro schemes kept going and they were very stable and they were really completely unaffected by the pandemic. Our traditional distribution channels of restaurants, bars, shops for our spirits completely closed overnight, and there was a massive pivot towards e-commerce and the growth of those direct channels. And so, like others, we had to move pretty quickly, which I think we did. We learned a lot about e-commerce and direct channels in a pretty short space of time. We were on a property development site, two property development sites, I think, and the contractors both went bust during the pandemic. So that was definitely something that didn't have in our business plan. But I think the overall learning for us from it was that we were very thankful that we operated things on a conservative basis in terms of our balance sheet, which meant that those shocks and bumps we could pretty easily ride out and come through the pandemic. So I think it taught us even more to be conservative and long-term in our approach rather than the opposite.
It feels like some great learns there as well around e-commerce and things which probably have stayed in the business post-pandemic and have actually made the business stronger and allow you to access growth in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was also great, not just for people in our business. When you look back at it, everybody had to make these decisions. And there were some really difficult decisions around who we had to put on furlough, who we didn't have to put on furlough, how we were going to get through it. And that wasn't unique to our business. That was pretty much across the board for every business, certainly here in the UK. And I think we were stronger because of it, as many other businesses will have been, have come out of it and survived. You go, okay, look, that was tough, but we've learned a lot about it. And you learn a lot about your people in those sort of, you know, the people who really helped us pull through, we were really very thankful to, who put in long hours, well beyond anything that was in the job description or what we'd expect them to do. And hopefully that was partly because of our ability as a family business to pull together.
They're really wise words around the learns that businesses generally took, as you say, William, from pandemic. And we certainly see, when we speak to a number of clients in a number of industries, the one skill set that management teams seem to have really built in the last few years is resilience and adaptability, because anything can happen, to your point, which I think is a really good lesson. And as Jamie has mentioned actually earlier, we're currently working with the FT and we've been surveying a number of businesses around the UK around their own growth aspirations. And interestingly, a thematic coming out is the stick or twist. So they may have been traditionally very regionally based businesses, but the one commonality is one of growth. And how do they access growth? Do they spread within the region? Do they spread nationally? And I think those different channels to market as well, as you say, e-commerce, may be a big factor in that. So on that, have you seen a structural shift, do you think, since the pandemic in your sales of the business and e-commerce just being so much more important than perhaps you thought it would be 10 years ago?
Well, I think certainly here in the UK, the pandemic just expedited what was happening anyway with people buying more and more online. And when COVID ended and we were all allowed out and about, I think people in general have drifted back to the shops. But I don't think e-commerce has regressed back to the stage where it was pre-COVID. You know, Amazon's still hugely popular. People are still buying their Christmas presents late on the 22nd of December, knowing that it'll arrive. So I think it's fundamentally changed consumer habits for good. But I think there has been a rebalancing of those channels as in the last few years, people have been going out, enjoying restaurants and bars and buying things in physical shops again. So I think there has been a rebalancing.
And I would agree with that and get Jamie's views on that in the moment as well, if I may. But we certainly have observed the rebalancing, as you say, because there's an experiential type of thing here, isn't there, for people missing out almost on the experience. So just before I turn to Jamie, specifically, I was really interested in your whiskey business and where you are conducting e-commerce. It's a really high quality product. It's an experience, ultimately. But if they're touching it through an e-commerce channel to begin with, you have lots of 5 centiliter products there, which I'd imagine is the way to give people a bit of a taster of the quality of this product. Has that been a focus of the management team with growth, thinking about how to market the experience ahead of perhaps taking on loyal customers for a repeat business?
Yes. One of the things we've had a strong focus on, we've got some active visitor centers at the distilleries where we're getting up to sort of 50,000 people through the door a year now. And so that for us is a very important marketing channel because people come in and they experience a brand. They're not just seeing the bottle on a bar and they're engaging with the people who make the product. So that's a very important marketing channel for us. And then the test has been to convert that footfall into then going away, communicating with them via email, social media, so that hopefully then you create some sort of brand loyalty and then when they're making buying decisions online, they will lean towards your spirits.
And Jamie, in relation to your own experience, when you think about the clients yourself and your team are engaging with, kind of as William describes, we're almost rebalancing, aren't we, post-COVID, in the optimum balance between an e-commerce sale and an experience sale as well. Is that a key agenda item for growth on other clients' agendas, would you say, at the moment?
Yeah, I think businesses are looking about all the routes to market and how to maximize that in the most efficient and effective way. And obviously, e-commerce is a very efficient way to do that. So I would agree that we're seeing a lot of businesses explore those opportunities, you know, new products to existing clients, new products to new markets, whether that's overseas, whether that's domestically. So definitely, I think people have changed their views on just following the traditional routes and actually starting to explore other ways or other partners in which they can distribute products or services around, and William's business is a great example of that.
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. So William, a little bit earlier, you talked about when management teams make decisions, the importance really of surrounding yourself with alternative opinions, advice, advisors, specifically in relation to the role of banks when management teams are pursuing a growth strategy. What would be your advice to other businesses about the importance of engaging with banks?
Well, obviously, they're a key source of capital, and I would advise them to engage with banks early so they know whether they have sufficient liquidity to achieve the capital expenditure that they want to spend. And then obviously, from their own perspective, to stress test the borrowings against basic serviceability, gearing ratios. And as we've seen, you know, in the last, whatever it is, 2 years, we've had a very rapid increase in interest rates, and to make sure that in the worst case scenario, hopefully you can survive, whether it's a trading downturn combined with an increase in interest rates, and make sure that you've stress tested that and communicate that to people like Jamie.
Thanks, William. And I think that's really sound advice. And Jamie, from your perspective, What would you advise, I suppose, in terms of William's point around the importance of early engagement when a business is starting to really think seriously about a significant strategic shift or a growth ambition?
Yeah, as William said, I think early engagement is key. I know really understanding the project or the investment plans that the management team have, and really just trying to, as William touched on there, in terms of helping them with the sensitivity analysis, looking at the base case and really, really testing the robustness of the financial models. Doing that on a very open book, very transparent basis, I think is hugely important. And we just want to learn and understand the businesses, their direction of travel, and try and sit alongside them and support them to achieve their ambitions. And delivering some of the growth is always great to see in these businesses when you've stood alongside them.
Yeah, well said, Jamie. Thank you. William, if you were to pull all this together and you were an advisor to management teams who are on that growth decision-making journey, if you were to try and summarize it down to up to three golden rules that you would have that management teams should always have front and center of their mind as they go through that cycle of growth decision-making, in a few words, what do you think they would be?
Well, I would be prepared to listen to other people and have some good advisors with more experience than you, and not to think you're always right. So to have open ears, I think, is one. Secondly, to make sure that your business model is as robust as it can be, particularly in terms of the balance sheet and stress testing, that it can survive various downside scenarios. Yeah, it'd be really those two, I think.
I mean, that's fantastic. I love the open ears suggestion as well. Something that I'll try to adopt as well in my own business.
William, one question from me, if I may, in terms of the business. It's obviously so diversified in terms of geography. One of the challenges that businesses find is when they're quite far from all the different operations is how do you manage something on that scale and that diversity in terms of geography?
Well, I think trust is an important part of it. You've got to get to know your management teams, particularly those overseas, and you've got to make the effort to build relationships, and you've obviously got to have a lot of trust between them and us and vice versa. And luckily, in general, those management teams stay with us for the medium term. So we're not appointing managers for a year, 18 months, 2 years, 3 years. There are a number of examples across the group where they've been with us for quite a number of years, and we like to try and develop people internally where we can. For example, we had one person who joined us here in our Scottish office, and he's now, for the last 3 or 4 years, been managing director of our Australian business. So he's been with us a number of years, and we hope he'll continue to develop within the group. And we have a lot of faith and confidence in him, and hopefully vice versa. So that's just an example of how we try and approach the sort of human resource aspect of it all.
So it's just trying to have that common culture right across the group, and, as I say, trust and having good people in good positions that you can rely on.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, William, for all of the insight you've given us so far today. I'd actually just like to ask you two or three personal questions, if I may.
I'm ready.
If I were to ask you, what advice would you give your younger self?
My younger self? Assuming I wanted to do what I've done, I think experience is key, and get sort of rounded experience of various businesses and sectors. And once you've got those experiences, go with your gut feel, because by and large, once you've got those experiences, it's probably right.
That's great. Thank you, William. And if I pivot slightly, and again, going back to the past, if you were starting out again in life, in business, what would your dream job be?
Okay. Does it have to be in business?
No.
Okay. Well, I would be, I'm very glad I didn't do this, because I really wouldn't have been very good at it, but I would have been a professional cricketer or a professional golfer. But sadly, I wasn't good enough at either of them. So I would have been one of those two.
I think I would have answered the question the same if you'd asked me.
Well, I would have come back as Finn Russell, probably.
That sounds amazing. And again, if you think about all of the experiences in business that you've had, which are very extensive, what's the biggest opportunity, would you say, that you've taken?
I don't think there's one single opportunity that we've taken that outstrips the rest of them. I think it's just been, hopefully, a reasonably balanced approach to what we've been trying to do to grow the family business for the next generation, and to be a sort of custodian of it, rather than go all out for very, very strong growth and get a number of big decisions wrong, and finally, you're left with not very much.
Well, thank you so much, William, for your time today, and also to Jamie. I really enjoyed the conversation. I think it's been fantastically insightful. And, you know, when we think about the topic of growth, it's always on the mind of pretty much every enterprise. And it's a bit of a puzzle to unravel. And I think you've given us some really good pointers today. So thank you.
It's been very nice to speak to you both, and some very penetrating questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow us to receive notifications of new episodes as they go live. For more insights or to find out how we can support your business, go to barclayscorporate.com. Copyright Barclays Corporate Banking, all rights reserved. Terms and conditions available at barclayscorporate.com.